Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 206, and you guessed it, it's time to dissect the hocus pocus of episode 205. In episode 205, we introduced the principal written documentation around what happened to the limousine from the point it arrived at Parkland and began its journey back to the White House garage. We read verbatim the Charles Taylor security memo, the James Rowley letter to J. Lee Rankin, penned on January 6, 1964, and finally, the December 18th internal Ford memorandum, penned by Ford employee Vaughn Ferguson. We'll spare you from reading the White House garage logs, even though we will refer to their contents as an integral fourth document set. Other statements made by Mr. Hess from the Hess and Eisenhardt garage will also soon come into play as well. And of course, the star witness will be George Whitaker, the supervisor of Ford's Rouge plant in Dearborn, Michigan. Neither of these last sources have been introduced yet, but they will be soon enough. But first, let's simply point out the main inconsistencies between these documents that even without going to Dearborn, Michigan, or speaking with Mr. Hess in Cincinnati, bring out suspicion as to whether the documents are the whole truth or not, at best. And even more nefariously, they seem to contain some elements that are written in a way as to be deliberately deceptive about what really happened. Good investigators lead where the evidence points. So let's start simply with all the problems contained in that existing body of evidence, the three documents mentioned just now. Let's start with the duration of the special security detail led by Charles Taylor. Arguably a smart thing to do. Floyd Boring, or perhaps Rowley himself, made the decision. But either way, through Boring, an extra layer of protection was ordered up, ostensibly to protect the integrity and chain of evidence related to the limousine. In Taylor's own memo documenting the security detail, he stated that the special protection ended at 4:30 p.m. on Saturday. By that time, both the Secret Service and the FBI had gone over the car, extracted evidence, and both parties had undergone a photo shoot, with the FBI pictures taken during their review in the wee morning hours of Saturday, between about 1 a.m. and about 4 a.m. And the Secret Service pictures taken toward the end of the afternoon on Saturday, with the special security detail wrapping up right after that, 4:30 p.m. Saturday, as clearly stated in Taylor's memo, that Saturday is November 23rd. So why then does it clearly state in Chief Rowley's memo that the security detail extended all the way into Sunday night, November 24th? Here is what is the first puzzle element. Rowley states this in his January 6th memo. Yet he also attaches Taylor's memo to his own memo when submitting it to J. Lee Rankin. The error, then, is most obvious to anyone reading the entire submission carefully, but not necessarily just the cover memo. So what to make of this? Attaching the Taylor document may be evidence that the inconsistent date in the Rowley memo is simply innocuous. Simply a mistake by Rowley. So, to anyone just reading Chief Rowley's memo and not going any deeper, it clearly puts a continuing ring of protection around the car until well into Sunday night. And that's when later events that we will explain show that it was highly unlikely the car stayed in the garage on Sunday. You see, no security detail, unless people see it leave, if any, on Sunday, Well, that's nefarious, if it occurred. It's also possible that even Raleigh himself realized that it was a mistake, either way, to have ended the special security detail before getting the official okay from the FBI to do so, waiting for the FBI to confirm that they were finished with their forensic examination of the limousine. This premature ending of the security detail is likely clear evidence of a procedural screw-up or a planned event. If it was just a procedural screw-up, then perhaps Rowley just wanted to paper over it, like some administrators do, and not reveal that it was accidentally shut down too early, and thus assert that the additional security surrounding the car was maintained until they got final clearance from the FBI to cessate those activities around this piece of evidence. Any of these scenarios seems plausible without further review. But let's continue to progress down this rabbit hole before anyone comes to a conclusion on which of these scenarios is more likely. Oh, and I will say this again, Rowley's statements clearly placed the limousine in the White House garage on late Sunday night. Later, you are going to ask yourself, how could that possibly be, when a highly credible witness is going to attest that the limousine was back at Ford's Rouge plant that night, Sunday night, in Dearborn, Michigan. And also a feat that only seems possible in the allotted time if it were flown there on a big old C-130 cargo jet. And remember, it was winter. And you will hear from Doug Weldon himself later that the weather was bad, the roads were bad, and it was a 1,000-mile drive. And it was also, at that moment in time, the most noticed limousine of the 20th century. Can you imagine a road trip with that car at that moment with the backdrop of the assassination days fresh? Being transported like that across the country? I think everyone should pause before they believe that this limousine was driven to Dearborn, Michigan from the White House garage or from Michigan to Cincinnati, which is precisely what is stated in Chief Rowley's memo. At least for me, that dog doesn't hunt. Pretty outrageous and arrogant that they would represent that the car even be considered for transportation in that fashion. And even more so, with the now added dimension of it being an ongoing piece of evidence in a murder case just days old. Now, let's turn to the involvement of the Arlington Glass Company, a local glass company in the D.C. area that supposedly was called to put a new windshield into the limousine. The Arlington Glass Company was a local D.C. area supplier chosen by F. Vaughn Ferguson, the Ford representative introduced earlier in the story. They were to come and replace the windshield in the limousine. Now, let's stop right there. Does it make sense to any of you listening that over that weekend, at a moment when the president's autopsy was barely completed, that someone in charge would make a decision to begin physically dismantling the epicenter of the crime scene of the century? That is, the limousine. Well, that is exactly what began to happen. The windshield was removed and replaced by somebody, and perhaps more than once, by more than one group. There was a valiant attempt to clean the interior, and especially the blood that had seeped into the carpets, scrubbing away on the carpets with baking soda. And when that didn't work, replacement carpets were ordered immediately. My God, can you visualize this scene? And then, on top of it, lap robes in the trunk were found to be soiled and contain traces of blood, and they too were brought to the cleaners. No pictures or review of those were ever noted. The crime scene was essentially obliterated. Granted, there is no controversy that the Secret Service and the FBI went over the limousine and performed a review Friday night. But what law enforcement jurisdiction in the country would then release the car for dismantling and reconstruction? Almost immediately. Before the crime was even solved, before Oswald himself was murdered. So, especially at that moment, the preservation of evidence against a man still living and so charged with the murder of the president, evidence that would have been critical to preserve for reference in a murder trial, was not. So the next logical question is, who ordered this and why? And if one was doing it for nefarious reasons, then what innocuous pretense might they put forth? Again, only seeking the truth here, but if you are not suspicious yet, I'm not sure what else would make you suspicious. I'm just saying. Well, let's start with one of the hocus-pocus clues, and one that is contained in the Raleigh memo. It's on page 4, and for anyone who is into proper grammar, the paragraph commences oddly, pivoting into this next subject as if to slip it into the conversation. And read in context with the information before and after, it's oddly situated grammatically. Okay, that probably doesn't mean anything to you all right now, I know. But if you read the memo or go back and listen to my articulation of it in the last episode, you'll know what I'm talking about. It says this, and it starts out, "When, on Sunday afternoon, November 25th, 1963, Chief Paterny instructed Special Agent Gies to do whatever was necessary to clean the car to make it available." Well, Special Agent Gies understood this to mean to do whatever was necessary to place the car in operating condition. He instructed F.V. Ferguson of the Ford Motor Company to arrange for the replacement of the windshield. The windshield was replaced on November 26th by personnel from the Arlington Glass Company. Special Agent Davis was present during the removal of the windshield and verifies that this was carried out as described by Mr. Ferguson in his memorandum on December 1, 1963. Special Agent Gies was also present part of the time while the windshield was being removed. Well, let's explore this. First, the question of who gave such an order. Raleigh says that Secret Service Chief Paterny, a higher up in the Secret Service, I believe PRS hierarchy, told Gies it was okay to do what was necessary to clean the car. And Raleigh states that such an order was given by Paterny on Sunday afternoon, to Gies, presumably after the FBI gave the all clear okay sign. Well, first, on the timing of it, here is the thing. We know that the Secret Service personnel in the garage had already performed a first cleaning of the limousine on Saturday, likely before any okay came in from the FBI. We know that because the Ferguson memo that we read earlier states so, and Ferguson's memo specifically says this. In his memo, he states that he got to the garage for the first time on Saturday morning, November 23rd, at about 10 o'clock a.m., and then the memo goes on and states, and I quote, "The following day, when I returned to the garage, the unit was no longer under guard." That following day, of course, would have been Sunday. He then goes on to say, right afterward, that the Secret Service had cleaned the leather upholstery the day before, going on to say that underneath the upholstery buttons, dried blood was still in evidence. And on my own initiative, I pulled up these upholstery buttons and with a knife removed the caked blood around them at this time. There was a heavy odor of dry blood that was still noticeable. Well, the day before, folks, is Saturday. So I think it's pretty clear that we can conclude that the Secret Service at least partially cleaned the car on Saturday, not Sunday. At least the first time around. And I think it's probably safe to say that someone gave those Secret Service agents at the garage permission to do so. And probably it was Chief Paterny, just not on Sunday. But where was Paterny getting his orders from to obliterate an active crime scene? Perhaps Raleigh? And then, where was Raleigh getting his orders from? Well, one clue to that is a comment made in Pam Brown's book, based on her interview of Von Ferguson. She would say that Ferguson was told directly by Lyndon Baines Johnson to get the limousine ready for Monday, that it would be used in the funeral procession. or somehow in the funeral. There is no taped interview or other evidence that I've observed of this, but on its face, if it occurred, as represented by Pam Brown, well, it's heartless. And given all that we know, it seems as if it might mean much more. Chief Rowley's oddly written paragraph goes on to add more veracity to the details of this riddle. Go back and listen to it or read it carefully again. Rowley goes to great lengths in that paragraph to explain how Special Agent Geez was given instruction to clean the limousine. And then Agent Geez misconstrued the instruction. Misconstrued it so badly that he thought the instruction meant to do anything that was necessary to get the car in operating condition. And, of course, that led to Geez giving instruction to Ferguson to replace the windshield. How do you go from simply cleaning the car to deconstructing it and then reconstructing it? And, of course, in the process, obliterate a crime scene. How do you do that without getting real clear on the instructions? Well, the obvious answer is just exactly what was revealed. It was a request by the newly installed president to use the limousine in the funeral. Totally insensitive in all aspects of decorum. Obviously, and I suspect, sadly enough, totally consistent with some of the documented characteristics of this new President Johnson. What an elegant excuse and cover when one wants to destroy evidence and do so almost immediately. This decision to attempt to use the limousine in the funeral is tragic, and it's sickening, and it goes to exactly what people were thinking and doing underneath the covers at the very moment of this national tragedy. As therapeutic as it might have felt to those Secret Service men, perhaps a great relief to get the okay to clean out the limo, perhaps erase a bit of the most traumatic moment of their existence, many of them so emotionally stunned, I'm sure, by what had happened. Despite that truly human element of it, well, don't tell me that those agents didn't understand what they were engaged in. It was pure and simple the destruction of a crime scene and related evidence. They knew it. They all knew it, regardless of where the orders came from. Now that you've stopped shaking your head, is the elegant cover story just that? The crass initial orders of a new leader? Or does it represent something deeper and more nefarious? I mean, for God's sakes, who would order up the use of that limousine in the funeral parade? Was the new president planning on having Jackie climb in the car with he and Lady Bird? This is truly one of the most macabre moments of the entire 206 episodes we have done so far, if this is true. And I have no reason to believe that it is not. Oh, and just for the record, Rowley explicitly states that the limousine was cleaned up late Sunday night, just as I mentioned before. He describes it this way in his letter to Rankin, and I quote, "On Sunday, November 24th, Special Agent Geez requested Deputy Chief Paterny for permission to begin to clean up the car since the odor from the car was becoming offensive. This permission was granted after clearance from FBI. Late Sunday evening, November 24th, the guards were removed from the vehicle and Special Agent Geez and Special Officer Davis and White House Police Officer Hutch began to remove the bloodstains and the debris from the car. At that time, there were still fragments of bone and hair in the debris of the car, which had not been removed by the FBI search team. Now, we know from the earlier Taylor memo that the special security, the guards, ended at 4:30 p.m. the day before, on Saturday. And we know from the Ferguson memo that no additional security for the car was there on Sunday when he arrived, if he in fact even did so. We also know from his memo that the car was cleaned on Saturday. That's right, that the limo had already been cleaned, at least partially, by the Secret Service on Saturday. Ferguson details much that happened the following week, beginning on the 25th, the ordering up of the new carpet, and then the subsequent receipt of it by the White House personnel, and then the installation of it in the removable floor pan by the White House upholsterer, and then the return of the pan to Ferguson for installation in the vehicle itself. If all of this is indeed what happened, then it's a shame that one of the earlier researchers never tracked down these records and the rest of the remaining witnesses involved to verify these things. Maybe another question for Vince Palomara. The carpet was ordered from Hess and Eisenhardt, and so there should have been records of that. Why is all of this important? Well, you will soon hear, or have already recalled, from George Whitaker's testimony that the limousine was torn apart at the Dearborn plant on Sunday night and Monday. Maybe the exercise was that they might have just been looking for other bullet holes to patch or other evidence to obliterate without actually replacing the carpet. And then perhaps they just simply reinstalled the old bloodstained carpet that night. Like I say, perhaps. And that would seem to make sense, because carpet was likely custom, and it was likely part of what the Hess team in Cincinnati was responsible for related to that custom car. Probably not even on hand in Dearborn. And even if it was, if you were covering up something, you don't want any evidence that the car went somewhere and something was replaced, when it wasn't even supposed to be there to begin with. Obviously, this is all conjecture, but it's a detail that continues to be unaddressed in the story. Now, let's turn particularly to the replacement of the windshield itself. Raleigh says this in his letter to Rankin, and I quote, "The windshield was replaced on November 26th by the Arlington Glass Company. Yet in the Ferguson memo, Ferguson states this, and I quote, in response to my call of November 25th, personnel from Arlington Glass came to the White House garage that same day to replace the windshield." This is a clear discrepancy in dates, and it's important. The 26th is the Tuesday following the weekend, but Ferguson's account of it is that he called Arlington sometime on Monday, and they came trotting out and replaced the windshield the same day, on Monday. Ferguson's account of the dates are more problematic than Raleigh's, actually. First, the White House garage logs show no one there on Monday the 25th from the outside. No Arlington Glass, no folks outside the coterie of approved Secret Service agents and White House police, coming or going. Once you hear witness George Whitaker from the Ford Rouge plant, you will know why these entries in the Ferguson memo appear to some to be a cover-up, because the presidential limousine cannot be in two places at once. And Monday, November 25th, is likely to be a date seared in the mind of most who lived in that era. President Kennedy's funeral took place that day. It was more than memorable. It was unforgettable. And then there are the statements of George Whitaker that the limousine was in Dearborn, Michigan on Sunday night and Monday, and not the White House garage. It also seems at least curious to me that Ferguson was able to simply call the local glass company up in the morning and have a replacement windshield available for installation that afternoon. More would have to be explored. But in those days, parts like that were not normally just kept on the shelf. And this was a luxury automobile, not produced in anywhere near the production volumes that other Ford vehicles were produced. One more reason to believe that a perfectly fitting windshield was not just lying around on a shelf at the Arlington Glass Company, ready to be placed in a vehicle. And, as you will hear from George Whitaker, that the windshield must have been a custom fit, because in Dearborn, they had to use the old windshield as a template to make a new one. I think if this windshield were indeed a custom-sized windshield, and someone could prove that definitively, that would seal the deal for me, that the statements made by Ferguson about this windshield replacement being ordered up and occurring all on the same day, on the 25th, are just plain false. I'm leaning that way anyway, but I'm just saying. Has there been anyone that tried to get a hold of the Arlington Glass Company records to verify any of this? The routine availability of a properly fitting windshield for the Lincoln? The availability on that day? November 25th, records to show that it was purchased and delivered, and reliable witness testimony from the Arlington employees who hoisted that thing probably onto some big glass truck and hauled it out to the White House garage, then removed the old windshield and then installed the new one. Where are those folks? I'm sure they're gone today, but you have to wonder if maybe they told the story to their families. You have to wonder, though, if it even happened at all. Or perhaps, in an absolutely crazy twist of the story, you have to wonder if it actually happened twice, once in Dearborn and once in D.C. at the garage. Both Doug and I will explain shortly. Ferguson was focused on remediating all of the blood that had trickled down into the removable floor pan, the pan that held the carpeting. He would go on to state, after his own attempts to clean things, that he would conclude that the carpet needed to be replaced. And again, late in the afternoon on Monday, the 25th, according to his own memo, he orders up new carpeting, including masking and binding, for a fix. But how could he do this on Monday? Again, the car was not even there. That's if you believe George Whitaker. And you believe the White House logs that no one was there on Monday. Well, maybe Ferguson already had the particulars in hand from his Saturday and Sunday visits to the garage. And he did order them up on Monday, just without the car being there. Because again, if you believe George Whitaker, the car was in Dearborn. Hocus pocus. Ferguson starts right off in his memo stating that he was only allowed to see one thing that Saturday morning, his first look at the car, and that was the windshield, and he makes a big deal of noting that there was no hole. Now, why would he make it a point to state something like that, something that he didn't see? Think about it. This is one of Doug Weldon's points, and it rings true with me, too. Ferguson would say this, and I quote, "Examination of the windshield disclosed no perforation, but substantial cracks radiating a couple of inches from the center of the windshield at a point directly beneath the mirror." I mean, look, it's not entirely implausible that you might ask yourself, did a bullet go through? But it's very explicit, and I get why Doug challenges that a little bit. What gets weird, though, in the memos about the windshield is this. First of all, Rowley's odd paragraph referenced earlier makes it appear as if the original decision to replace the windshield at all is a misunderstanding by Agent Gies to make the car operational. That Gies did that without explicit orders to do so. But there is more in the Rowley memo. He explicitly goes through an extensive discussion to explain why the photo of the windshield taken by the FBI somewhere between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. ostensibly during the wee hours of Saturday evening during the FBI's forensic review, why that photograph doesn't look like the windshield that is currently stored under lock and key at the White House garage at that moment in early January. Imagine that. The photo taken that night doesn't match what the windshield looks like now. And they all know it. And Rowley wanted to make sure that documented in his memo was a very plausible reason as to why. And he does his best to do just that. He begins by quoting key Secret Service agents in the chain of possession of the car from Dealey Plaza to its arrival at the garage. Agent Hickey drove it to Love Field from Parkland, and Agent Kinney drove it to the garage. Neither acknowledge a bullet hole in Rowley's memo version, and both agents say that you could drive the limousine without being distracted by the damage. Hardly evidence or reasonable explanation even of a change in the damage, the cracks or the crack pattern or their locations. A change from the time the windshield was photographed to now. And while these were more of a setup than an explanation in his memo, the lead-up is evident. He even throws in comments by Agent William Greer, the driver of the limo in Dealey Plaza. Greer didn't remember any damage to the limousine. Imagine that. PTSD, of course. Now, I'm just saying. He does, however, introduce the learned comments of Agent Gies, who sees the car for the first time as it arrives at the White House garage. Gies himself concluding that the additional driving and the flight back to Washington, and then finally the extreme temperature change that the car underwent once it parked inside the White House garage contributed to the weakening and then subsequent cracking that produced a windshield that now looks considerably different than the FBI photograph that Rowley attached to his memo. Well, maybe so. I don't doubt that all the jostling around after the window was first compromised at the moment of the assassination, well, all that jostling did indeed produce additional cracking or deterioration. And I might even buy the change in temperature as they entered the garage. But what is virtually unexplainable are the differences in the exact location and extent of the original damage as captured in the photos. Photos that include images of the windshield. Photos taken by James Alkins, for example, in Dealey Plaza. Taken almost right at the moment of the assassination. When compared to the location and nature of damage on the actual windshield contained in the archives, and differences produced by the comparing all of this to the FBI pictures supposedly taken during the FBI forensic review, well, none of this adds up. This dog just doesn't hunt. But if you thought that was interesting or suspicious or however it is that you categorize it, here's the coup d'etat of evidence destruction. And if it weren't so tragic and tragically stupid, it would be downright funny. Ferguson explains it in his memo, and it's the story of how the windshield was removed by the Arlington Glass personnel. It goes like this, and I quote, "The Arlington Glass personnel advised Morgan Gies and me that the removal would cause additional damage to the windshield, but Gies told them to go ahead and remove it anyway. The Arlington Glass personnel did remove it by putting their feet against the inside of the windshield and pushing it out. In doing so, additional cracks formed downward to the bottom of the windshield. Mr. Davis of the Secret Service then took the windshield and put it in the stockroom under lock and key, and I have not seen it since." Folks, you just can't write this stuff. I don't know. Maybe it was 1963, and maybe there was no CSI television show, and maybe everybody was just not that in tune. But honestly, that dog doesn't hunt either. None of this adds up to anything that trained law enforcement professionals would be doing in 1963 related to an investigation of the murder of the President of the United States. No, sir. The dent in the windshield is also given special attention by Rowley in the memo in an overt attempt to represent that the damage was not from a bullet. He would go on to say that Agent Gies thought it existed prior to the assassination and that it happened on November 1st at the Empire Garage in New York. It appears that Rowley knew that the story might be fact-checked, so he included a comment from the garage's supervisor, who seems to say that he couldn't remember, but that it was possible that it could have happened there. There was no evidence that they actually talked to the two mechanics at Empire regarding if they themselves recall making the damage. It is an absolutely classic investigative sleight of hand. They went far enough to prove their own point, never thinking that this memo would probably see the light of day, or that someone may ask the simple question, such as, "Did you actually talk to the two mechanics?" Ferguson's inclusion of a comment regarding the steps taken to clean the lap robes is also somewhat suspicious. I could almost understand why there might have been a bit of blood on them if there was blood that Agent Kinney or one of the folks helping him, perhaps Agent Hickey, had on his person and somehow it made its way onto the lap robes in the trunk as they were taking out the bubble top, perhaps, at Parkland. All that's plausible, but what is curious to me is that they were also soiled. Those lap robes were like blankets to be placed on the laps of passengers, or at least placed in a way that they would come into contact with clothes of the president and his wife and other inhabitants of the vehicle. They would have to be crisp. They would have to be pristine clean. What then got them so soiled? Maybe I'm just reading too much into this one, but it makes me wonder whether those lap robes may have been used for some other purpose. regardless, what we do know from the Ferguson memo, if it can be believed, is that White House chauffeurs sometime that next week were required to take the lap robes to Fort Myer cleaners and have all of the blood and all of the soil completely removed. I'm certain that no samples or forensic review of those lap robes took place. Obviously, under the circumstances at that moment, nobody would have thought to do that or thought it would have anything to do with the case. And certainly with the players involved, nobody would have done it. It certainly appears to me, 60 years later, as just one more minor hanging chad that could have produced perhaps something of interest. Perhaps less related to the president's blood, as I'm sure it was the president's blood, but more related to what else those lap robes might have been used for. Let's turn now to two more important dates. We know that the limousine, as stated in the official records, did finally make its way out of the White House garage. First to Dearborn, Michigan, and then finally from Dearborn, Michigan to Cincinnati, to the Hess and Eisenhart shop there. In Raleigh's letter to Rankin, he states that the limousine was driven on December 20th from the White House garage to the Engineering Research Division of the Ford Motor Company, located in Dearborn, Michigan. Raleigh identifies Von Ferguson as the driver, and he states that the purpose of delivering the car to Dearborn was to redesign a new bubble top. Apparently, redesigning a new bubble top took only 4 days, or perhaps even three, because Raleigh then goes on to say that on December 24th, the car was then driven from the Ford Motor Company to the firm of Hess and Eisenhart for the express purpose of manufacturing and installing a bullet-resistant bubble top. Now, as I recall, it took about 4 years to design the entire car, but apparently it took only 3 days to design a new bubble top. Don't you wish they had taken three more days in the very beginning? There are problems galore with these dates. There are various newspaper accounts, including the following, that began to appear in the first 2 weeks of December. Starting around mid-December, Pamela Brown cites a series of newspaper articles that began to imply that the limo is somewhere other than the White House garage. Brown points out that many of them have something of a secretive nature in how the information is being reported on, as if it should not be revealed, yet revealing it, essentially having the look and feel of some sort of plant or disinformation campaign. First cited is a UPI article in the Cincinnati Post on Tuesday, December 17th, 1963, saying that the limousine was in Dearborn Saturday night, December 14th, and would be at Hess and Eisenhart this week. Then there is another article from a Michigan paper, the Henry Ford, on December 17th, 1963, that the car actually arrived December 14th, or Saturday night, at the Experimental Garage in Dearborn. The Experimental Garage is where the SX-100 was built and where the car was serviced from time to time when it was in Dearborn. Later, another article in the Henry Ford stated that on December 12th, 100X reached Ohio and was reported that the car had been stored in Dearborn, Michigan under a disinformation campaign. I guess the basic question is not whether these articles were designed to create confusion. They did, for sure. But they point to someone needing to say something publicly. The question is, was one of those stories planted to create more confusion, perhaps, after the original story got leaked and onto the airwaves? Was the whole thing designed to create some error of logic around the secret locations of the car? Or are these just the snippets of what a good investigative reporter might have uncovered? Now, I don't think anyone really knows, to be honest with you. But for sure, they add the weight of evidence that something secretive was going on with the limousine. For sure. Well, enough from me already. Next, you'll hear from Doug Weldon directly. And as for this point we just discussed, well, you'll hear Weldon state that he talked to the elder Mr. Hess, the owner of Hess and Eisenhart, Hess would confirm that the limousine arrived around December 12th, I believe, or 13th, in Cincinnati, and he was sure that it arrived by military aircraft at a nearby Air Force base, as I had mentioned earlier. The representations in the Raleigh memo that the car was driven first to Dearborn, Michigan, and then from Dearborn to Cincinnati, and on the dates closer to Christmas, are completely refuted by the statements and the records held by Hess and as relayed to Doug Weldon. It seems that the only reason for the government lying about these dates is to have some plausible deniability in a broad and general way if a controversy would ever develop about when and where the limousine was and just what was being done to it at that moment. That seems to be what is happening right here before our eyes. Ferguson's memo reinforces that he was the, quote, driver of the limousine as it trekked across the country. So, after hearing what we have already heard, it seems to me that this is one more corroborating lie. Planted square in the middle of the Ferguson memo. A lie that's right there, a lion on the rug. There may have been another important reason for the Secret Service to ship the limo off late in December for reconstruction of a new bubble top, and done right before Christmas. That would ensure that it was conveniently unavailable for a recreation event in Dealey Plaza that had been decided upon by the Warren Commission, an event that would have put the vehicle in plain sight in front of the world for all to see. Instead, the old Queen Mary, the 679X, would get the nod off the bench for that series of downs, so to speak. No doubt, Robert McNamara had a team working on what to do with the car, and it involved him and members of his staff, as well as the Secret Service. So more was involved, it meets the eye, in the decision to retain the car in an operational capacity. But for sure, it was not necessarily one person's decision. At least not on the surface. This story, of course, gets even more fantastic when the rest of it is told by Doug Weldon. Weldon stumbles across where the limousine really was Sunday night, November 24th, and Monday, November 25th, before it was returned at some point, probably to the White House garage. And more importantly, it's the story of what really happened to the limousine. An even more bizarre exercise to remove the windshield, the one with a bullet hole in it, replace it with a windshield that has no bullet hole in it, and of course, that's the real hocus pocus. Many of you know this story already, and so hopefully what you have heard from me as a prelude makes even more sense. And for those of you who haven't heard what is coming next from Weldon, well, you're in for a treat. So let's take a pause, and it's morning where I am, so I'm going to do something different. No sandwich this time. I think I'll shake it up and cook some scrambled eggs and hash browns. Maybe even add some onions to those hash browns. Kick it up a notch. Now there's a dog that hunts. Don't worry, I'll be right back before you know it with my next episode, episode 207. And there, we'll pivot to Weldon and his story. Folks, like I said, you really can't write this stuff. Thank you for listening to episode 206 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.